The last couple weeks we've been talking about Solomon, the third king of the nation of Israel. And we've seen as we looked at these kings how God chose Saul, and Saul failed to choose God or failed to trust God to lead him and direct him from the very beginning of his kingship. And as a result, God rejected Saul and his lineage from continuing and went and chose a man after his own heart, David. And we saw that David was a man after God's heart, and we see the reign of David being the pinnacle, the key time that Israel looks at as far as being the best time of their existence and the best king that they ever had. He was followed then by his son Solomon, and that's who we've been talking about the last couple of weeks. And we see that Solomon was blessed very much by God. We'll talk about that in a bit. And so we've talked about Solomon the last couple of weeks, and today we're going to kind of move on. We're moving on to the next set of leaders of Israel. And we're going to see that, Israel no longer exists as Israel. The three kings that we've seen so far, Saul, David, and Solomon, ruled over a united Israel. We've seen various times during their reigns where we've seen some splits. Especially with David, he had a couple of times where the northern tribes split off from David at the very beginning when they first followed Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, before they accepted David. The southern tribe went with David, Judah. Then we also saw later after Absalom's rebellion that Sheba of Bichri led the northern tribes away. And so you've got some times there where we've seen some splits, but now we're going to see a permanent split. Okay? So we'll be talking about the divided kingdom. We only have three chapters we're going to go through today, but there's a lot of meat in those chapters, and in fact, we're going to end up skipping most of one of the chapters just on account of time. So let's kind of dive in. Let's pick up where we left off with Solomon. And we see that, I mentioned to you that Solomon was very blessed by God. And in what ways? Turn back to the beginning of Solomon's story in chapter 3. Of 1 Kings, starting at verse 12. This is after God asked him to, what would you like? And he decided that he wanted wealth. God kind of granted him a wish. And in response to that, God was pleased in verse 10 that Solomon had asked for wisdom. So he said in verse 11, so God said, since you've asked for this and not for long life or wealth for yourself or for the death of your enemies, but that you've asked for discernment in administering justice, I mean, that's great, Solomon. And so as a result, I'm going to do what you've asked. I will give you a wise and discerning heart so that there will never have been anyone like you, nor will there ever be. Moreover, though, I will give you what you've not asked for, both riches and honor, so that in your lifetime you'll have no equal among kings. And if you walk in my ways and obey my statutes and commands as David your father did, I'll give you a long life. So God blessed him. God blessed Solomon greatly with wisdom. He's the wisest man who ever lived, except maybe Jesus, okay? He blessed him with fame. We saw that people came from all over to see Solomon and to hear his wisdom and to see his wisdom in action. Blessed him with wealth, great wealth. We've looked at that. Blessed him with peace. He had peace on all sides. Both under Saul and David, the country was always at war, but it was a time of peace, and people felt secure and happy, and they had a chicken in every pot or a vine in a fig tree in every home kind of thing. And he blessed him with a long life, or he promised a long life as long as Solomon would remain faithful. Okay? So great blessings that God gave to Solomon. Some of this blessing was contingent upon his faithfulness. Did Solomon try to obey God and follow God as his father David had? Backing up in verse 3, it says that Solomon showed his love for Yahweh by walking according to the statutes of his father David, except that he offered sacrifices and burned incense on the high places. We've talked about what that means. The king went to Gibeon to offer sacrifices, for that was the most important high place, and Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. So we see that he started out faithful, following in the footsteps of his father, the faithful footsteps of David. A little discernment problem with the high places, And we'll deal more with the high places as we go on in future weeks. Okay. One other thing about Solomon's reign that we talked about especially last week is there was something that Solomon did that David longed to do. It was what he really, really wanted to do, but he couldn't. And what was that? Chapter 5, verse 2. Solomon sent this message to Hiram. Hiram was the king of Tyre, who had been on good terms, we see in verse 1, with David. And Hiram wanted to continue that with Solomon, and so he sent some envoys. And the response that Solomon gave was, verse 3, "You know that because of wars waged against my father David from all sides, he could not build a temple for the name of Yahweh his God until Yahweh put his enemies under his feet. But now, Yahweh my God has given me rest on every side, and there's no adversary or disaster. I intend, therefore, to build a temple for the name of Yahweh my God, as Yahweh told my father David when he said, 'Your son, whom I will put on the throne in your place, will build the temple for my name.'" So David longed to build a temple to God, but God wouldn't let him. He was a man of blood, a man of violence. Okay, and he said, "Instead, I'll raise up a son to you. His name will be Peace." That's what Solomon means, it's peace. Shalom. And he will be the one who will build a house for my name. So we saw last week that David did everything he could up to the limit of building the temple. He provided for it. He drew up the plans and designed it. He got all the materials. He got craftsmen working on pieces and stuff so that when Solomon took over and Solomon was ready to build the temple, a lot of it was already ready and it was just a matter of construction. All right. Let's see. Now, another aspect of Solomon is tax burden, okay, and this will kind of set the stage for a little bit of today. If we take a look, we saw how wealthy he was, and we saw that he had a lot of wealth, but he demanded a lot of wealth. He had a lot of construction projects. We really haven't talked about it much, but it says that he built up lots of cities and fortified lots of cities, building these huge walls and gates and protection elements around a bunch of cities in Israel. That's not cheap. It takes a lot of money. Plus, he also kind of lived high on the hog. We looked a little bit at the book of Ecclesiastes where he talked about his efforts in trying to find the meaning of life, and he tried all sorts of stuff. He tried being productive. He tried being just having fun. He tried being extravagant. He tried just you name it, and they were all futile. They were all meaningless, but it brought them all to the conclusion. And this, the wisest man on the earth, had to search for this, and brought him to the conclusion that what life is really about is living in God's blessings and following God, trusting Him, putting your faith in Him, having a relationship with God. That's what it's about. You may have gone through or studied the purpose-driven life from Rick Warren, and that's his conclusion. It's not about us, it's about God. And that's what we're here for. And that's the conclusion Solomon came to. But in his efforts to chase this down, some of the extravagance, he imported all sorts of things. 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 22 says that he had a fleet of trading ships at sea along with the ships of Hiram, and this would be at the Mediterranean Sea. We saw elsewhere already that he had fleets of ships down in the Red Sea and caravans that would go over land to trade things. And this fleet of ships in the Mediterranean Sea is that every 3 years it would come back carrying gold, silver, ivory, apes, baboons. Okay, what do you need apes and baboons for? It's just entertainment. So you see that he lived very extravagantly here. In verse 28 and 29, we see that he imported horses from Egypt and from Kew, which is up in Asia Minor, which is Turkey today. The royal merchants purchased them from Kew. They imported a chariot from Egypt for 600 shekels of silver and a horse for 150. They also exported them to the kings of the Hittites and to the Arameans. So he brought in lots and lots of horses and chariots and just tons of them. How many is tons? Go back to verse 26. It says that Solomon accumulated chariots and horses. He had 1,400 chariots. Now, chariots are kind of like the tanks or the Humvees of that day. 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horses. Okay? Takes a lot of money to buy those. Takes a lot of money to keep them up. and to feed him and to take care of all this. And he kept these in the various chariot cities as well as with him in Jerusalem. Okay, so now one thing about this getting the horses from Egypt, it says here, you know, you'd have a little trade deficit with Egypt trying to get all these horses and vehicles and all that. But that wasn't the only problem with it. If you turn back to Deuteronomy 17, verse 16, and this is back with Moses, and God giving the law to Moses, it says, and he talks about the king, and we've looked at this verse a little before, but in verse 16 it says, "The king, moreover, must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself, or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them, because the Lord has told you you're not to go back that way again." So God made it very clear that don't go to Egypt, don't trade with Egypt, don't get horses from Egypt. Okay? So, but he did. Let's see, what other kind of needs did the government have or did Solomon have? Back in chapter 4, it talks a little bit about just his daily rations, the daily requirements that he had to feed his household and feed his government, take care of his government. Verse 22 of chapter 4 says, "Solomon's daily provisions were 30 cores of fine flour and 60 cores of meal." That's a lot of cores. Well, that works out to 560 bushels of flour and meal. This is all, took a lot of manual labor to grind and to harvest. That's a lot. And 560 bushels, and that's every day. On top of that, in verse 23, his daily requirements included 10 head of stall-fed cattle, 20 of pasture-fed cattle, and 100 sheep and goats, as well as deer, gazelles, roebucks, and choice fowl. This is every day requiring all of this. How did he get it? Well, one way he got it is verse 27. It says that the district officers, and he set up districts, 12 different districts throughout Israel, kind of equal size kind of thing, not necessarily according to tribal lines. But the district officers, each in his month, supplied provisions for King Solomon and all who came to the king's table. They saw to it that nothing was lacking. They also brought to the proper place their quotas of barley and straw for the chariot horses and the other horses. So how did he get the provisions? He taxed the people. And every month, one of the districts was responsible for providing all this stuff that was needed for all the days of that month. Not just what we just read, but also the food for the horses and all other provisions that the government needed. Okay? So very, very heavy taxing. Not something that a district could take care of in one month, so the district obviously had to stockpile during the year and to prepare for the month that they had to take care of. So you had very heavy taxation. I mentioned that he had a lot of construction projects, not just the temple, but he built this huge palace. He built palaces for his wives and shrine. Well, we'll talk about that later. He built the city walls. He constructed a lot of things. Where did he get the laborers for these building projects? Chapter 9, verse 20. "All the people that were left from the Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites," these are the ites that are not Israelites, okay? "That is, their descendants remaining in the land whom the Israelites could not exterminate, well, these people Solomon conscripted for his slave labor force, as it is to this day." So, where did he get his labor force? He turned all the non-Jews in Israel into slaves. The people who shouldn't be there in the first place, the people who should have been wiped out by Joshua and the people following them and the Israelites at Joshua's time and thereafter, that were still around, Solomon turned them into slaves. Okay? How many laborers? Well, let's just look at a few aspects of the laborers. This doesn't count all the construction people and the like, but if you look at chapter 5, verse 13, you see that just for bringing stuff, you see a huge number of people. Verse 13 says that King Solomon conscripted laborers from all of Israel, 30,000 men. He sent them off to Lebanon in shifts of 10,000 a month so that they spent 1 month in Lebanon and 2 months at home. Adoniram was in charge of this forced labor. So he had 30,000 woodcutters. That's what, when it says he sent them off to Hiram in Lebanon, that's what was up there, is the cedars of Lebanon that were, that's the wood that they used to build the palace, to build the temple, to build things that needed to be made out of wood. And so he provided laborers for that, and 30,000 men were involved with that. Continuing on, verse 15, Solomon had 70,000 carriers, water carriers, okay, and 80,000 stone cutters in the hills, as well as 3,300 foremen who supervised the project and directed the wood, the workmen. So 70,000 carriers, not water carriers, but carriers of the stones and people to haul the stuff, and people, 80,000, who were cutting the stones in the hills that were brought down for his construction. We see that the manual laborers were these slaves, but where did he get the foreman and also his military people? Turn to chapter 9, verse 22, which continues on where we left off there. It says that Solomon did not make slaves of any of the Israelites. Okay, they were his fighting men, his government officials, his officers, his captains, and the commanders of his chariots and charioteers. They were also the chief officials in charge of Solomon's projects, 550 officials supervising the men who did the work. Where did he get the leaders, the government people, the foremen, the military people? That was kind of forced labor. He conscripted and grafted Israelites to do that. Okay, he forced them to do it. But you see that they were not called slaves. It says that he did not make any slaves of the Israelites. Why not? I mean, that sounds a little semantics, doesn't it? Look back at Leviticus chapter 25, verse 42. And one of the laws says that because the Israelites are my servants, whom I brought out of Egypt, they must not be sold as slaves. So the command is there that Israelites were not to be slaves. It was forbidden to make an Israelite a slave. So Solomon didn't make them slaves. He just made them, he drafted them into service. Okay. So you see that Solomon's government, Solomon's extravagance, his building projects, put a heavy burden on the people. He put a burden of taxation, put a burden of labor, put a burden of forced labor on the people. Okay, so there we see some problems that he's creating for the government. You look back at what Samuel told the Israelites when the Israelites pushed Samuel to provide them with a king. He warned them, this is what a king's going to do, and that's what Solomon's doing. The same things that Samuel had warned them. Okay? All right, well, going on. We left off at the end of verse chapter 10. Let's continue on in chapter 11. And we'll see further degradation here. What command had God given Israel that Solomon just totally, completely ignored? Chapter 11. King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter. Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. They were from nations about which Yahweh had told the Israelites that you must not intermarry with them because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods. So what command did he totally ignore? Marrying outside of the family of Israel. He married all sorts of places, all sorts of women. Why? Well, he wasn't original in this idea. We saw that David did it. David had wives from various places. And a big part of it was for political reasons. We see that they married... Well, here you see that he loved Pharaoh's daughter. Okay, well, what happens when the king of Israel marries Pharaoh's daughter? Makes friends there, right? And you have an ally there, so that keeps Egypt from attacking, and it keeps good relations. And that's what he did. He married women who were daughters of kings or sisters of kings all around. A lot of political marriages, weddings here. What's the problem with that? The problem is that God had commanded not to do that, because if you intermarry with others, they will lead you astray. That's what God had warned, and God said, you must not intermarry with them because they'll turn your heart to other gods. Now, was this a new command to Solomon? If you've been around looking at this, you might remember back Deuteronomy 17:17. Well, actually, back to Abraham. the Israelites were commanded to be a separate cut-off people. That's what the whole circumcision covenant is about, is a reminder of that, and commanded not to mix and intermarry and intermix with others. You've seen that throughout the history of Israel. But what about the king? I mean, this is maybe for political reasons. Well, Deuteronomy 17 is where it's talking, that we looked at the verse 16 already, where it talks about the king. And in verse 17 it says that the king must not take many wives, or his heart will be led astray. Plus, he must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. These two verses here, verse 16 and 17, you know, lays out very clearly a few things that the king should not do. He shouldn't accumulate horses, get them from Egypt. He shouldn't accumulate wives, and get a bunch of wives from other nations. He shouldn't amass silver and gold and extravagance because of the burden and because of putting their trust, the king would put his trust in that, in mammon, not God, right? So here we see Solomon is breaking all of those rules. He broke the rules on the horses, on the Egypt, on the wives, on the silver, on the gold. Okay. Now, it says the king should not take many wives. Did he really take many wives, or did he just fall in love with a lot of different women? Going on, chapter 11, verse 3. Solomon had 700 wives. You know, we're not talking a dozen here. We're not talking 6 or 12 or even 100. We're talking 700 wives of royal birth. Royal birth, so you see, for the political reasons, and 300 concubines. So 700 weren't enough. He had 300 other women at his disposal at all times. And what happened as a result? His wives led him astray, just as God had warned. So did he take many foreign wives, or did he just fall in love with a bunch of them? There's no way he could fall in love with 1,000 women like this. He took many wives directly against God's command. How was he, was he led astray as God had warned? It says that he was. So how? Verse 4, as Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to Yahweh his God, as the heart of David his father had been. In fact, he followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of Yahweh. He did not follow Yahweh completely, as David his father had done. In fact, going on, in a hill east of Jerusalem, Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable god of Moab, and for Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. He did the same for all of his foreign wives, who burned incense and offered sacrifices to their gods. So these wives came in, they had their own gods from their nations, and he supported that. And he built shrines for them so that they could worship that. Built shrines in Israel, in God's country. Not only that, he worshipped them too. He was led astray. We'll see more about some of these gods, especially Molech, as we keep talking. You'll see him over and over a few times, and Ashtoreth. This is Solomon's big downfall. Okay, he turned away, and by turning away, he's to be the example, and he's to lead the people in faithfulness in God. And what's he doing? Is he's leading them astray. And so not only is Solomon led astray, but the people are led astray by him as well. So what happens as a result of that? As you would expect, God has something to say about that. And so God chooses some punishment here. Verse 9 of chapter 11. Yahweh became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from Yahweh, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. Twice. You know, God doesn't appear very often to people. And he had appeared to Solomon twice. And Solomon turned from him. Although God had forbidden Solomon to follow other gods, Solomon did not keep God's command. So the Lord said to Solomon, since this is your attitude, and you have not kept my covenant and my decrees which I commanded you, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you, and I will give it to one of your subordinates. Okay, God had said, I want to continue to bless you. I want to give you a long-lasting dynasty. I want to bless you during your reign and your descendants during their reigns. But this is all contingent upon you living in a right relationship with me, just as your father David had. So as a result of Solomon rejecting God and turning to other gods, God is rejecting Solomon. Okay? So he would tear Israel away and give it to someone else. Not just someone else, but to a subordinate, someone who's currently working for Solomon. Right? But, you know, you look back, and didn't God promise to David that because of David's faithfulness, he would always have a descendant on the throne? Well, actually, the promise said, as long as your descendants remain faithful, as you've been faithful, you will always have a descendant on the throne. So, did Solomon turning from God kill that? Going on, verse 12. God says, "Nevertheless, for the sake of David your father, I will not do this during your lifetime. I will tear it out of the hand of your son." So there's some grace there. Solomon's the one who deserves to be punished, but because of his promises, because of his love for David, and because of David's faithfulness, he said, "I'm going to spare it during your lifetime, but your son, Solomon, is the one during his lifetime that I will do this." But, verse 13, I will not tear the whole kingdom from him, but I'll give him one tribe. I'll give your son one tribe for the sake of David my servant and for the sake of Jerusalem which I have chosen. Okay? So out of God's grace, he would leave one tribe in David's lineage because of David's faithfulness. Alright, going on, the next batch of verses, we're not going to read all these, verses 14 through 25, or actually through 27. It talks about adversaries that Solomon had. Okay, during most of his reign, he had peace. But because of his rejection of God, God allowed problems to pop up. Just like during the times of the judges, when God let enemies pop up and create problems for the Israelites. And that's what we see here. We'll just look at a few quick verses. Verse 14. "Then the Lord raised up against Solomon an adversary, Hadad the Edomite from the royal line of Edom." And the next verses tell the story of Hadad. You see that Hadad was part of royal stock, and when Joab, David's commander, was in Edom mopping up the Edomites, he ran away and ran to Egypt for protection, made good friends with Pharaoh there, so much so that Pharaoh gave him his sister in marriage, and they lived together happily and were good friends. When Hadad heard in verse 21 that David died and that Joab had died, he then went back to Edom and took over rule there. And now you had this enemy to David's line, which included Solomon, there in Edom. And then verse 23, God raised up against Solomon another adversary, Rezin, son of Eliada, who had fled from his master, Hadadezer, king of Zobah. And then he gathered a bunch of rebels together, and when David had destroyed the forces of Zobah, and the rebels went to Damascus and took control, and he ruled in Aram, which is Syria today, and was hostile towards Israel. Rezin was in Aram, which is on the north, the northern border of Israel. The southern border of Israel was Edom, and so he had Hadad there. So God had enemies, adversaries, problems to Solomon, both on the north and on the south. And then on top of that, in verse 26, Jeroboam, son of Nebat, rebelled against the king. He was one of Solomon's officials, an Ephraimite from Zerida, and his mother was a widow named Zeruah. So one of his own officials, someone in his own government, rebelled against him. So Solomon had adversaries, had enemies, had problems with people to the north, to the south, and within his government, within his country. Okay. So let's talk about Jeroboam. The next few verses talk a little bit about him. Who was he? Verse 28, "Jeroboam was a man of standing, and when Solomon saw how well the young man did his work, he put him in charge of the whole labor force of the house of Joseph." Okay, the house of Joseph would be the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh, right? The two sons of Joseph. So he was just a regular worker, and Solomon was impressed with him, and so Solomon put him in charge of the labor force. These are the slaves that we talked about, that Solomon made the non-Israelites be slaves. And actually, we skip verse 27, which basically says that Solomon built the supporting terraces around Jerusalem and filled in the gap of the wall of the city of David, the southern part of Jerusalem. how did he do that? He used his labor force, and the thought is that Jeroboam led that labor force, and that's why that verse is there. It's talking about that. So Jeroboam, though, we saw in verse 26, even though he was trusted and raised to a high position by Solomon, Rehoboam rebelled. Why? Did he rebel on his own? Did he decide that he wanted to rebel against Solomon, this great king? Or did something prompt him to do so? Verse 29. About that time, Jeroboam was going out of Jerusalem, and Ahijah, the prophet of Shiloh, met him on the way, wearing a new cloak. The two of them were alone out in the country, and Ahijah took hold of the new cloak that he was wearing and tore it into 12 pieces. You don't tear clothes. Okay, today clothes don't cost you much, but in those days, all fabric was handmade, hand woven, and people didn't have a big closet full of clothes and new clothes all the time like we do. They had one set, two sets of clothes that would last them for years. And here, Ahijah had a new cloak, and he tore it into pieces. What do you think when you see that? Well, he's making a special point out of this. This is an important thing. So he tore it into 12 pieces, and he told Jeroboam, take 10 pieces for yourself, for this is what Yahweh, the God of Israel, says. See, I'm going to tear the kingdom of Solomon's hand out of Solomon's hand and give you 10 tribes. So you see that the rebellion of Jeroboam was not something that he just thought he would do. It was something that God called him to do. Okay, God chose him and sent the prophet Ahijah to call him into rebellion. Okay, so this is the fulfillment of the promise of punishment that God had given to Solomon. So even though the country wouldn't be torn out from Solomon during his lifetime, he would still have this problem with Jeroboam here. Now, here though, he's only given him 10 pieces. Why didn't he give Jeroboam all of it and just turn the whole tribe over? Well, we've already heard that, but he tells Jeroboam this too. Verse 32, for the sake of my servant David and the city of Jerusalem, which I've chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, he will have one tribe. Okay? For the sake of David's faithfulness, God was going to keep one tribe for David's descendants. Well, does anybody have any confusion here? He's given 10 tribes to Jeroboam and leaving one tribe with David. That was 12 tribes, right? 10 plus 1 do not equal 12, do they? Well, the one tribe for David is what tribe? What tribe is that going to be? Well, we'll find out, but it's going to be Judah, the same tribe that always stuck with David. Okay, the other tribes are the ones that would go away. Well, Judah, if you look at a map of where the tribes settled, Judah was in the south, but they weren't the only ones in the south. There was also Simeon. But if you look at Simeon's borders, Simeon bordered one tribe, and that was Judah. And it bordered Judah on all sides. In other words, it was in the middle of Judah. So Simeon and Judah counted really kind of as one tribe. So when it talks about one tribe staying with David, it's talking really about those two tribes that just kind of merged together. So we know, because we've seen what God had told Solomon, why this is happening and how it's happening and the like, but now we see that Ahijah is telling Jeroboam that he's going to get it except for that one tribe, or that double tribe of Judah, which is going to stay with David because of his faithfulness. Why is this happening? Ahijah tells him, verse 33, I will do this because they have forsaken me, and they worship Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Chemosh, the god of the Moabites, and Molech, the god of the Ammonites, and they have not walked in my ways, nor done what is right in my eyes, nor kept my statutes and laws as David, Solomon's father, did. So that's why I'm going to do this, is they've forsaken me. They worship other gods, they worship idols, they have not walked in my ways, they have not followed my commands. So, out of punishment to Solomon and his lineage, this is what I'm going to do. And when is this going to happen? Verse 34, he says, I will not take the whole kingdom out of Solomon's hand. I've made him ruler all the days of his life, not for his sake, but for the sake of David my servant, whom I chose and who observed my commands and statutes. I will take the kingdom from his son's hands, and I'll give you 10 tribes. I will give one tribe to his son, so that David my servant may always have a lamp before me in Jerusalem, the city where I choose to put my name." Solomon would keep all the tribes. Jeroboam would not take those 10 tribes yet. Not until Solomon was gone, and Solomon's son was then in charge, and that's when Jeroboam would take them. And then he keeps going. There's a little bit more that God, some promises that God makes to Jeroboam. "However, as for you, I will take you, and you will rule over all that your heart desires, and you'll be king over Israel. If you do whatever I command you, and you walk in my ways, and you do what is right in my eyes by keeping my statutes and commands, as David my servant did, I will be with you. I'll build you a dynasty as enduring as the one that I built for David, and I'll give Israel to you." So what kind of promise is he making? Does this sound familiar? This is the same promise that he gave to Solomon, same promise that he's given to David, same promise he gave to Saul, same promise he gives to his leaders is, you stay with me and I'll stay with you. Okay? You live in a right relationship with me. You follow me, you obey me, and I will bless you. That's the promise that God made to Jeroboam. If you have a heart after my heart like David did, I will bless you. I will build a dynasty for you just as I've built one for David. Now, if this wasn't supposed to happen until Solomon was gone and Solomon's son was in charge, then what would Jeroboam do all this time? But we see that Jeroboam and Ahijah were out there by themselves. Does Jeroboam keep his mouth shut? Well, in verse 40, we see that Solomon tried to kill Jeroboam. So somehow or another, somebody said something, or word got out, or for some reason, Solomon tried to kill Jeroboam. So Jeroboam fled to Egypt, to Shishak the king, and stayed there until Solomon's death. Okay, so he did not try to rebel against Solomon or try to fight against Solomon. Maybe he did. Maybe he started doing something that made Solomon suspicious, and that's why Solomon tried to kill him. We don't have those stories here. But we do see that Jeroboam went to Egypt and stayed there until Solomon had died. We see the conclusion of Solomon's reign in verse 41. You'll see this as a common refrain when the Bible here closes up the stories about the reign of a king. It says, "As for the other events of Solomon's reign, all he did and the wisdom that he displayed, are they not written in the book of the annals of Solomon?" Okay? So in other words, all right, that's all we're going to talk about here. There's other stories, but you can go look at the other books for those. Well, those other books we don't have now, but we do have the stories that God felt were most important for us to have and put them in his word. Okay? And we see in verse 42 that Solomon reigned in Jerusalem over all of Israel for 40 years, the United Kingdom of Israel. And then he rested with his father and was buried in the city of David his father, and his son Rehoboam succeeded him as king. So now we have Rehoboam as king. Did Israel immediately accept Rehoboam as the next king? You know, we saw that they accepted Solomon, okay, because David had pronounced him as king. But we didn't really see that all of Israel accepted David, even a couple of times. What about Rehoboam? Going on, Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all the Israelites had gone there to make him king. So yes, they did. They accepted Rehoboam to be their next king. So they all went to Shechem, which is an important place. We've seen Shechem a number of times in the past. And they went to Shechem, which is in... It's not in Judah, it's in Ephraim, I believe, one of the northern tribes. And so they all went there to make him king. But you know, they had a request for him. And what might you think that request would be? Is there any problems that they would hope this new king could solve? Well, how about the heavy taxes? How about the heavy drafting and labor force and all that? Well, let's look at that. Verse 2. When Jeroboam, son of Nebat, heard that Rehoboam was king, he was still in Egypt where he had fled from King Solomon, he returned from Egypt. So they sent for Jeroboam, and he and the whole assembly of Israel went to Rehoboam and said, so they called Jeroboam to be their spokesman. And they said, you know, your father put a heavy yoke on us, but now lighten the harsh labor and the heavy yoke that he put on us, and we'll serve you. So you see, Jeroboam's not going to him and saying, hey, y'all don't follow Rehoboam, follow me. But instead, they go and they say, hey, just make things a little easier on us. Don't be so rough on us, and we'll follow you, and you'll be our king. Okay? So they asked to lighten the load, lighten the tax, reduce the tax, lighten, and we've talked about the heavy load that Solomon had put on them. Well, what does Rehoboam decide? Well, in verse 5 he says, okay, go away for 3 days and then come back to me. So the people went away. Rehoboam is young, he's new as a king, this is a pretty tough decision. What's he going to do? So he wants to think about it a little bit, he wants to talk to his advisors, and so he talks to his advisors. Verse 6, he consulted the elders who had served his father Solomon during his lifetime, the ones that were still around there, okay, who had given good advice to Solomon, and said, how would you advise me to answer these people? They replied, if today you'll be a servant to these people and serve them and give them a favorable answer, they will always be your servants. Okay, so they say, yeah, do what they say, and they will love you for it, and they will follow you forever. So is that what he did? Verse 8. Rehoboam rejected the advice that the elders gave him and consulted with the young men who had grown up with him. Okay, no more wisdom than he had and were serving him. He asked him, what's your advice? How should we answer these people who say to me, lighten the yoke that your father put on us? Well, the young men who had grown up with him replied, tell these people who said to you, your father put a heavy yoke on us, but make our yoke lighter. Tell them, my little finger is thicker than my father's waist. My father laid on you a heavy yoke. I'll make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I'll scourge you with scorpions. And they said, hey, you're new at this. They got to know that you're boss. They got to know that you're the king. So you stand up and you show that you're strong. You show that you're strong by being tougher than your dad was tough. Okay, show them who's boss. Okay, these wild ideas of these young men here. So which advice did Rehoboam follow? Verse 12, 3 days later, Jeroboam and all the people returned to Rehoboam, as the king had said, come back to me in 3 days. The king answered the people harshly. Rejecting the advice given him by the elders, he followed the advice of the young men and said, my father made your yoke heavy, I will make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips, I will scourge you with scorpions. Okay? So he said he took the poor advice of his young, inexperienced friends. By the way, the scorpions here, it's not saying that he's going to take a bunch of these poisonous animals and hit them with them or whatever. But a scorpion was a type of a whip. It was a whip that had lots of strings on it, and at the ends of each strings, it had sharp iron points tied into it, kind of like the scourging that Jesus received. Very painful. He's saying, you think my dad was rough on you? I'm going to be even tougher. Okay? Why did he do this? That sounds pretty stupid. Sounds like the advice of the elders was a lot wiser. Why did he take this advice? Verse 15. So the king did not listen to the people, for this turn of events was from Yahweh, to fulfill the word that Yahweh had spoken to Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, through Ahijah the Shilonite. Okay? Why did he take this approach? Why did he make this stupid decision? Because it's part of God's plan. God had led him to make this decision, to take the poor advice of his younger advisors, so that the 10 tribes would then go to Jeroboam. So he gives this response. How do the Israelites respond to that? Verse 16. When all Israel heard and saw that the king refused to listen to them, they answered the king, what share do we have in David? What part in Jesse's sons? To your tents, O Israel. Look after your own house, O David. Okay, they revolted. They rejected Rehoboam as king. Just because you're a descendant of David, you're David's grandson, doesn't mean that we're going to follow you. What part do we have in you? We've rejected David twice. We're going to reject you too. In fact, that same phrase, if you look back at 2 Samuel chapter 20, the first verse, you see that that's basically what Sheba said when Sheba revolted and rebelled against David. He said, we have no share in David, no part in Jesse's son. Every man to his tent, O Israel. So you see the same refrain here saying, we reject David and his lineage. How strong was this rejection? Verse 18. King Rehoboam sent out Adoniram. He's the guy who was in charge of the forced labor. He had been during Solomon and even a little bit during David. He's been around for a while. But all of Israel stoned him to death. So he's not going to be around much longer. So you see that when he sent out his top official, someone that people would respect, they killed him. In fact, King Rehoboam, he was at risk, and he, however, managed to get into his chariot and escape to Jerusalem. He was in Shechem, so he ran away to Jerusalem and was able to escape before they killed him. And as a result, Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David to this day. Okay, so this rebellion, we have the split. We've got this civil split here between Israel. So what are the northern tribes of Israel? They've rejected Rehoboam. What do they do for a leader? Verse 20. When the Israelites heard that Jeroboam had returned, they sent and called him to the assembly and made him king over all of Israel. Only the tribe of Judah remained loyal to the house of David. So where we used to have one united kingdom, we now have two. The 10 northern tribes call themselves Israel. The southern tribe is now a country called Judah. Well, what did Rehoboam think about this rebellion? Verse 21. When Rehoboam arrived in Jerusalem, he mustered the whole house of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin. Okay, so some of the Benjamites were there too. 180,000 fighting men to make war against the house of Israel and to regain the kingdom for Rehoboam, son of Solomon. So what does he do? He goes and he mounts the army and builds the army. Now the army, any kind of army that contained people from the northern tribes, they're not going to be loyal to him. So he rounds up soldiers from the southern tribes and forms this huge 180,000 men fighting army, okay, to go and fight this civil war, to go take back Israel. So how did this battle go? Verse 22. The word of God came to Shemaiah, the man of God, so a prophet. God came to a prophet and said, "Say to Rehoboam, son of Solomon, king of Judah, to the whole house of Judah and Benjamin, and to the rest of the people, this is what Yahweh says. Do not go up to fight against your brothers, the Israelites. Go home, every one of you, for this is my doing." What's interesting is they obeyed the word of Yahweh, and they went home as the Lord had ordered. So Rehoboam accepted it. He didn't like it. He was ready to fight for his kingdom, but when it became clear that this was from God, he knew that it would be futile to try to fight against it, and he didn't, and he stopped trying to. Okay, so we now have two nations. The nation of Israel has split into Israel and Judah, the northern and southern tribes, or southern nations. Well, we have a capital in the south, right, which is Jerusalem. And that's not just the political capital, but that's also the religious capital. It's where the temple is. Well, what does Jeroboam do? He can't have his capital in Jerusalem. So what does he select as the capital? Verse 25. Jeroboam fortified Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim and lived there. See, Shechem is where they had gone to make Rehoboam king and where all this had happened. From there he went up and built up Peniel. So he built up a couple of cities and made Shechem his capital. If you look at 1 Kings 14, verse 17, you see that later during his reign, he moved the capital to Tirzah, which is just about 7 miles north of Shechem. Okay, but he started out in Shechem, then he moved to Tirzah. And then if you look at chapter 16, you see that it then changed a few generations later under Omri, verse 23 of chapter 16, in the 31st year of Asa, the king of Judah, Omri became king of Israel, and he reigned 12 years, 6 of them in Tirzah. He bought the hill of Samaria from Shemer for 2 talents of silver and built a city on the hill, calling it Samaria, after Shemer, the name of the former owner of the hill. So Omri bought this property, bought a hill. It's about 7 miles northwest of Shechem, so not far from Tirzah. But he, rather than living in an old city, he built a whole new city to be his state capital. And he called it, after the guy that he bought it from, Shemer, he called it Shemaria, Samaria is what we call it. And so that's where the capital was, and for the rest of the existence of the nation of Israel, that's where the state capital was. Okay? Now, we'll look ahead. Turn all the way to 2 Kings, and you see, we'll just look at the history. We'll give you, zoom to the end, okay? What happens to that nation of Israel, and why? Chapter 17 of 2 Kings, verse 6. In the ninth year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria captured Samaria and deported the Israelites to Assyria. He settled them in Hala and Gozan on the Habor River and in the towns of the Medes. All of this took place because the Israelites had sinned against Yahweh their God, who had brought them up out of Egypt under the power of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. They worshipped other gods and followed the practices of the nations that Yahweh had driven out before them, as well as the practices that the kings of Israel had introduced. So we see that 253 years later, so there's a lot of history, and we'll be going through that history over the next few weeks, but after 253 years of the existence of this northern nation of Israel, from the split that we see, it was destroyed. And the people were taken out of the area, and they were exiled to Assyria and scattered around Assyria. And to be honest, those people ceased to exist. They intermixed, and we never saw the lost tribes of Israel. Okay, you may have heard of that, and we'll talk more about that as we go on. Why did that happen? Because they had rejected God, and they had worshipped other gods, and that's what we'll see in the coming weeks. We'll see how that all pans out. But there's still that land there. If they took all the people out of the land, what happened to that land? The land of Israel that's called Samaria. That capital was called Samaria, but it also became known as the name for the whole land, the land of Samaria. People who lived there were called, rather than calling them Israelites, because Israelites would also mean the people of Judah, they called them people of Samaria or Samaritans, right? What happened to that land if nobody was there anymore? Verse 24 of 2 Kings chapter 17. The king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cutha, Ava, Hamath, and Sepharvaim, and settled them in the towns of Samaria to replace the Israelites. They took over Samaria and lived in its towns. And that's what the Assyrians did. Rather than, when the Assyrians conquered a nation, conquered a group of people, they wouldn't allow them to stay there. They exported them, and they mixed all the people up and brought other people in so that there wasn't a group of people who could band together and rise up against them. Okay? So that they got rid of the national cultures by dispersing people. Verse 25, when these people first lived there, they did not worship Yahweh because they weren't Israelites, right? They didn't know anything about Yahweh. So he sent lions among them, and they killed some of the people. And so they figured out, well, we need someone to teach them how to worship the God of the land, right? So verse 28, one of the priests who had been exiled from Samaria came to live in Bethel and taught them how to worship Yahweh. Nevertheless, each national group made its own gods in the several towns where they settled, and they set them up in the shrines the people of Samaria had made at the high places. And then verse 41, even while these people were worshiping Yahweh, they were serving their idols. To this day, their children and grandchildren continue to do as their fathers did. So, that land of Israel eventually was emptied out of the Israelites. Okay, and those people got intermixed and scattered and ceased to exist as a separate people. And the Assyrians brought in other people. They were trained to worship Yahweh, but they also had their own gods that they brought with them. And so it was a very polluted form of Yahweh worship. Okay, it was not the same worship of God that God wanted. As a result, these people were still around there during Jesus' day. And did the people of Judah, okay, the Jews, did they accept these people? Because they worshiped Yahweh, right? Did they accept those people as being brothers, brother Israelites? Well, they weren't, right? If you look at John 4, verse 9, when Jesus was talking to this Samaritan woman, the Samaritan woman said to him, "You're a Jew, and I'm a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews do not associate with Samaritans." Jews hated Samaritans. The Samaritans said, "Hey, we worship the same God. You know, we're just like you." And the Jews go, "No, you're not." You're not part of our people. You're not worshiping the same God. You're worshiping whatever God you want to worship, but you are not the same. And we'll see that when the Jews come back from Babylon under Ezra and Nehemiah. We see some of that too. But you see, what we're set up with here now with the split of the nations with Jeroboam and forming this northern nation, that carries on to Jesus' time. Okay? So, we have this capital of Samaria. And so now you see the link to the Samaritans. And when you hear the story of the Good Samaritan, you see some of the animosity there that the Jews had for them. You know, they not only were not Jews, but they said they were Jews, and they weren't. And so that made it even worse than other non-Jews. So the Jews hated the Samaritans. Okay, so we have the capitals there. What about... That's the political capitals. What about the religious capital? Where had God selected to put his name? Back at 1 Kings chapter 14, verse 21, says that Rehoboam, son of Solomon, was king in Judah. He was 41 years old when he became king, and he reigned 17 years in Jerusalem, the city that Yahweh had chosen out of all the tribes of Israel in which to put his name. And you look back at chapter 11, verse 36, you see the same thing, is that when God is talking to Solomon through Ahijah, or to Jeroboam through Ahijah, he mentions that Jerusalem is the city where he chose to put his name. So Jerusalem is where God wanted the temple built. That's where the temple was. Well, Jerusalem was under control of the southern nation of Judah, was under the control of Rehoboam. Jeroboam had a problem with that, right? Chapter 12, verse 26. Jeroboam thought to himself, his kingdom's will now likely revert to the house of David. If these people go up to offer sacrifices at the temple of Yahweh in Jerusalem, they'll again give their allegiance to their lord Rehoboam, king of Judah. They'll kill me, and they'll return to King Rehoboam. So Jerusalem was in Judah. People who would go to the temple would see friends and make friends there, and he needed to keep those people away from Rehoboam, away from Rehoboam's country. That was going to be a problem. Okay, they could form allegiances with Rehoboam. So how did Jeroboam handle this problem? Verse 28. After seeking advice, okay, well, sometimes advice is not good, the king made two golden calves. He said to the people, "It's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt." Does that sound familiar? That's the kind of thing that Aaron said, right? When Moses was up on Mount Sinai getting the Ten Commandments and made the golden calf, he said, "Here's your God, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt." And that's what Jeroboam says. He takes these two golden calves, and one he sets up in Bethel, which is in the southern part of Israel, and the other in Dan, which is way up in the north, so that people could go one way or the other, right? And this thing became a sin. The people went even as far as Dan to worship the golden calf there. So he made idols. He set up worship centers in Dan and Bethel so that people wouldn't feel like they had to go to Jerusalem. So he's trying to protect his nation by keeping the people from going to Jerusalem to worship Yahweh. But you know what? What did God, Yahweh said? He said, "You remain faithful, keep your people faithful, and I will bless you. But if you turn from me, I will reject you," just like I'm rejecting Solomon here. Now, you know, these golden calves, was he really trying to create his own religion, or was he just really just trying to keep people faithful to Yahweh, and he's just a little misled on this golden calf thing, and he's just trying to keep people out of Judah? Verse 31. Jeroboam built shrines on high places and appointed priests from all sorts of people, even though they were not Levites. God had said the priests come from the Levites, but Jeroboam said, "Oh, you want to be a priest? Okay, here you go." So anybody got to be a priest. He built shrines on high places where they weren't supposed to be. He instituted a festival on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the festival held in Judah, and offered sacrifices on the altar. He did this in Bethel, sacrificing the calves that he had made. Here he's doing the sacrificing instead of a priest of God. And at Bethel, he also installed priests at the high places that he had made. On the 15th day of the 8th month, a month of his own choosing, he offered sacrifices on the altar he had built at Bethel. So he instituted the festival for the Israelites and went up to the altar to make offerings. So is he intentionally creating his own religion? Yes. He builds temples. He builds shrines. He makes up festivals. He picks dates out of the blue. Makes up festivals. Makes up sacrifices. He sacrifices on his own as if he were a priest. Okay, he makes up priests. How carefully was he in selecting priests for his new religion? Chapter 13, verse 33 says that Jeroboam did not change his evil ways, but once more appointed priests for the high places from all sorts of people. Anyone who wanted to become a priest, he consecrated for the high places. Anyone who wants to be a priest, you're accepted. If you were a priest of Yahweh in Israel, what would you think of this? Well, it probably depends on how faithful of a priest you were. If you were a faithful person, a faithful Jew, or a faithful Israelite in Israel, and you saw what Jeroboam was doing in creating this religion, what would you do? Well, what did they do? Turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 11, verse 5, says that Rehoboam lived in Jerusalem and built up towns for defense in Judah. Okay, and then verse 13, the priests and Levites from all their districts throughout Israel sided with Rehoboam. The Levites even abandoned their pasture lands and property and came to Judah and Jerusalem because Jeroboam and his sons had rejected them as priests of Yahweh. And he appointed his own priests for the high places and for the goat and the calf idols that he had made. Those from every tribe of Israel who set their hearts on seeking the Lord, the God of Israel, followed the Levites to Jerusalem to offer sacrifices to Yahweh, the God of their fathers. By doing this, they strengthened the kingdom of Judah and supported Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, 3 years, walking in the ways of David and Solomon during this time. So you see that the faithful people saw what Jeroboam was doing. The priests of Yahweh left and they went to Judah, okay, and where they could continue to be priests of Yahweh. The faithful people, people faithful to Yahweh, they saw what Jeroboam was doing. They also left. People gave up their property, gave up their homes, and they moved south to Judah. And in doing so, they strengthened Judah, okay, and made Judah stronger faithfully and Israel weaker faithfully. Well, so Jeroboam starts this religion. Do the other kings that follow him, do they turn it around and straighten things up? Go back to 2 Kings chapter 17, where we saw the demise again. Verse 21. When God tore Israel away from the house of David, they made Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, their king. Jeroboam enticed Israel away from following Yahweh and caused them to commit a great sin, which is what we've just been talking about. But after him, the Israelites persisted in all the sins of Jeroboam and did not turn away from them until Yahweh removed them from his presence as he had warned through all of his servants, the prophets. So the people of Israel were taken from their homeland into exile in Assyria, and they are still there. So we see that Jeroboam started the train wreck and the other kings followed it. They continued in the sins of Jeroboam, and we'll see as we go on in the stories of these kings, some of them made it even worse. And God, we'll see that through this, God in his grace continued to call Israel to come back to him and continued to seek after them, but they continued to reject him. And so God eventually rejected them and punished them with this exile. And they cease to exist, like I mentioned before. All right, so Jeroboam is leading the people away. How does God make it clear to Jeroboam that what Jeroboam's doing was very wrong? Chapter 13. By the word of the Lord, a man of God came from Judah to Bethel as Jeroboam was standing by the altar to make an offering. Okay, Bethel was one of the two temples that Jeroboam had set up for these golden calves. This prophet cried out against the altar by the word of the Lord. O altar, altar, this is what the Lord says. A son named Josiah, and we'll see Josiah in a few weeks, will be born to the house of David. On you he will sacrifice the priests of the high places who now make offerings here, and human bones will be burned on you. Okay, this is an altar to this man-made God. God's going to demolish it and destroy it and punish the priests who make offerings on this and make sacrifices on it, and they'll be the sacrifices. That same day, the man of God gave a sign. This is the sign that Yahweh has declared. In other words, if you want to know for sure this is going to happen, the altar, this altar will be split apart, and the ashes on it will be poured out. When Jeroboam heard what the man of God cried out against the altar at Bethel, he stretched out his hand from the altar and said, "Seize him!" But the hand he stretched out toward the man shriveled up so that he couldn't pull it back. Also, the altar was split apart and its ashes poured out according to the sign given by the man of God by the word of the Lord. Then the king said to the man of God, "Intercede with Yahweh your God and pray for me that my hand may be restored." So the man of God interceded with the Lord, and the king's hand was restored and became as it was before. Okay, so God sent a prophet from Judah. Okay, this man came from Judah to Bethel and told Jeroboam that what he is doing is wrong, and told him about the punishment that God was going to do here. And he gave him these signs, gave him the sign of the broken altar and the shriveled hand. Okay, and Jeroboam saw that. Did that cause Jeroboam to change his ways? Zoom on to verse 33. "Even after this, Jeroboam did not change his evil ways, but once more appointed more priests for the high places from all sorts of people. This was the sin of the house of Jeroboam that led to its downfall and to the destruction from the face of the earth." Okay, so it's Jeroboam's sin of creating this religion, setting the nation of Israel off on the wrong foot, that ended up resulting in the destruction of not only Jeroboam's dynasty, but of the nation of Israel. Okay? So here you see the horrors that were brought into place by Jeroboam. He had a chance. God had said, "You be faithful to me, you follow in my footsteps, you have a heart after my heart like David did, and I will bless you, I will build a dynasty for you. Okay, you'll be my king." But instead, Jeroboam turned from God, so God then foretold destruction of Jeroboam's dynasty and the nation. We're skipping. There's a big story in chapter 13 of what happens to this prophet. And interesting reading. I'll let you read that on your own. Interesting story. So I'll leave that to you. Before we close, though, let's see. Okay, we've talked about the northern tribe and what Jeroboam did to the northern tribe. What about the southern kingdom? This kingdom of Judah that Rehoboam led. Did Rehoboam remain faithful? We see more about the southern when we look at Chronicles. So now that we've got two nations, we'll be bouncing around between the kings and the Chronicles, looking at the different, because you'll get more. The first and second Chronicles focuses more on the southern nation of Judah, where first and second Kings focuses on both of them and just doesn't go into as much detail about Judah. So how faithful does Rehoboam remain? Chapter 12. After Rehoboam's position as king was established and he had become strong, he and all of Israel with him abandoned the law of the Lord. So he started out faithful, but as soon as he felt secure as king, as soon as he felt the security that God gave him, he abandoned God and led the Israelites, the Jews, to abandon God. How did God respond to this rejection? Verse 2. Because they had been unfaithful to Yahweh, Shishak, the king of Egypt, attacked Jerusalem in the fifth year of King Rehoboam, only after 5 years, with 1,200 chariots and 60,000 horsemen, and the innumerable troops of Libyans and Succites and Cushites that come from Egypt with him. He captured the fortified cities of Judah and came as far as Jerusalem. Okay? So God allowed the Pharaoh of Egypt, Shishak, to come and attack the southern nation. And you see that he captured the fortified cities in Judah, and then he had left the prize, and that was Jerusalem, and he came and went to attack Jerusalem. The prophet Shemaiah came to Rehoboam and to the leaders of Judah who had assembled in Jerusalem for fear of Shishak and said, "This is what Yahweh says. You've abandoned me, therefore I now abandon you to Shishak." Okay? So this is God's punishment. And you are now going to be destroyed by Shishak because of your unfaithfulness to me. Okay, you reject me, I reject you. Okay? How does Rehoboam react to this? Verse 6, the leaders of Israel and the king humbled themselves and said, Yahweh is just. We deserve this. He's right. We haven't been faithful as we should. So they confessed. They repented. They accepted what God, the punishment that God was giving. How did God react to that? Verse 7, when Yahweh saw that they humbled themselves, the word of Yahweh came to Shemaiah, since they've humbled themselves, I will not destroy them, but I will soon give them deliverance. My wrath will not be poured out on Jerusalem through Shishak. They will, however, become subject to him so that they may learn the difference between serving me and serving the kings of other lands. So because of their repentance, God said, okay, I'm not going to destroy you. You're still going to reap some of the consequences of your sin, and you're going to learn the difference between serving me and serving others, so you're going to be subject to Shishak, but I'm not going to let him destroy you. Okay? So, does it matter if we repent and confess of our sins? You bet it does. Well, Shishak attacked Jerusalem. So what happened then? If God's not going to let him destroy it, what happens? Verse 9. When Shishak, the king of Egypt, attacked Jerusalem, he carried off the treasures of the temple of the Lord and the treasures of the royal palace. He took everything, including the gold shields that Solomon had made. So all the great rich things that Solomon had made and put into the temple and put into the palace, the stuff that we looked at last week and the week before, it's gone now. It's taken to Egypt. Okay, Shishak took it. He didn't destroy Jerusalem. He didn't destroy the people, but he took their wealth. Okay, and he made them subject to him. Now, why? And, well, obviously there's good reasons just to take the wealth like that. That's worth a huge amount of money. But how might Shishak have known about this? Well, if you remember back chapter 11, verse 40, when Solomon tried to kill Jeroboam, Jeroboam fled to Egypt, to Shishak, the king, and stayed there till Solomon's death. Do you think while Jeroboam and Shishak were together that he told Shishak about all the great wealth and riches? Do you think Shishak might have wanted to hear about how Jerusalem is laid out and where the wealth is and where the good stuff is and what good stuff there is? You know, so how did Shishak know about these things? He probably heard them from Jeroboam when Jeroboam was there in Egypt. Well, Rehoboam was not destroyed, was not killed, as would often happen in a conqueror like this, in a loss of battle like this. So did he feel safe and secure? Verse 10. King Rehoboam made bronze shields to replace the gold shields and assigned these to the commanders of the guard on duty at the entrance to the royal palace. So he remade the shields but made them out of bronze because he didn't have the wealth to make them out of gold like Solomon had. But what's interesting is verse 11. For Solomon, those shields in the time of peace, of Solomon's peace, those shields were just hanging up as decorations. But now in verse 11, whenever the guards went with Rehoboam, they bore the shields. And then afterwards, they returned them to the guard room. So these weren't decorations in the palace anymore. These were used as shields. And so he had an armed guard, a guard with guards with shields escort him around whenever he would go somewhere. Did Rehoboam have any threats by anyone other than Egypt? Back to 1 Kings chapter 14, verse 30. There was continual warfare between Rehoboam and Jeroboam. So yes, you had this constant civil war. Not a civil war that you saw battles every day and that kind of thing, but a constant fighting and enemy relationship between the northern nation and the southern nations, between these brothers. Okay? And we'll see how that continues to evolve as we go on from here in coming weeks. Let's pray. God our Father, we thank you for the stories that you give us. We thank you for this lesson and showing us that the actions that we take, the times that we turn away from you have consequences. They not only hurt our relationship with you and lead to deserved punishment or lead to consequences of our sin, but they affect other people, and other people can be led astray by what we do. Forgive us for that. Thank you for showing that, that they can have dire consequences, such as what happened to the nation of Israel because of Solomon turning away and being led astray by his wives, by the consequences that Jeroboam received by his dynasty being destroyed and not being blessed as he could have been because he turned away from you and led Israel astray. Strengthen us. Put your spirit in us so that we walk strongly with you. Forgive us when we turn from you, but continue to lead us back to you so that we in turn will not lead others astray and do not cause problems for others. We pray this in the name of the one that you sent to point the way back to you, to pave that way back to you, to make it so that we can live in a right relationship with you. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.